So thank you so much for coming to KPMG today to join us for this Questions of Life talk. So Questions of Life, it's a series of events that are running throughout Canary Wharf this week. And today we're going to be having Roger and Yvonne come and speak to us. And the topic, let me just make sure I word this right, is what if having it all isn't enough? So without further ado, I'm going to invite Roger up.
Good, thank you. Well, just before I introduce Yvonne, let me mention the fact that, first of all, it's great to be here. I am a Yorkshireman. I'd love to drop that in and let you all feel very, very sophisticated for a while. And it's great to be here. What a place that is, Canary Wharf. So thank you for having, and KPMG, thank you very much for hosting this. This is a whole series of events based around St. Peter's Barge and then in different venues around Canary Wharf. Do please take the things that are on your chair, and you'll see the invitations to other events throughout the week, and we'd love to see you. I bring always a little bookstall. I'd love to bring a big bookstall, but it's hard on British Rail, and so it's just a small bookstall. At the moment, everything that's out there is only £1 each, which if you were from Yorkshire, you would be very, very thrilled. And, but that's only because the two more expensive books, both of them went, so we've quickly run to get some more. They will be back. They will be there when we come to an end. But let me mention the two that I'd like to plug today. A Passion for Life. I mentioned this yesterday, we ran out of them. They're real stories, rather like I'm going to be interviewing Yvonne in a few moments. These are people whom I've interviewed in the past who tell their story of how they came to trust Jesus Christ and the difference he made. So we've got Vijay Menon, converted Hindu, you've got Rob the rapper, you've got the tattoo artist, the submariner, the rugby player, the immoral priest, what a story that is, etc. And then an explanation as to what it means to become a Christian at the end. They are just £1, so have a look at those. And then there are three hardback books like this. They really are hardback. They're solid, and they're just £1 as well, which is called What is a Christian. These are ideal to take and give to others, and if somebody says, where have you been this lunchtime, you can say, you know, I just went to a KPMG meeting and all I got was this rotten book, and then give them that, and who knows, you might be a real help to them. I want to read, if I may, a passage from the Bible, and you'll see why from the story, and then as I round things off, we'll go back to this very dramatic little passage. It's found only in John's Gospel, and I just think it's quite stunning, but you'll see its relevance in a few moments. It's in John, at the very end of chapter 7, going into chapter 8, and everyone went to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. And early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now, Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. What do you say? This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And those who heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? She said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Well, we'll come to that a little later. But first, it's my great privilege to introduce and interview, and basically I'm just going to be nosy again, Yvonne. Let's give her a very warm welcome. Yvonne, it's wonderful to have you here. Let's find out, where do you normally work?
I work at the regulator at the FCA, so I work in the internal audit division there.
Well, they're doing what?
I'm the director's PA.
Oh, right, so you know more about what he's supposed to be doing than he does.
It's a she,
all right, okay. So is that still true or not? Do you know more about her than she knows? You will be, okay. Quite possibly, all right. Does she know you're here now?
Yes, she does.
She does, all right.
She's on leave today, though.
Oh, right, so you didn't have to pull a sticky or anything.
No, okay.
Yvonne, tell us a little bit about your upbringing. Where were you born? Where were you raised?
I was born in Holloway, and my mum always makes me say, please make sure that you say it's not within the prison, because all right. I wasn't born in the prison. That's what Holloway used to be famous for.
Yeah.
To a loving, wonderful family. My mother's still alive. I've got one brother. I come from a massive extended family. My mother's one of 11, my father's one of 10, so I have something like 78
right.
First cousins.
This wouldn't be a Roman Catholic family.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it was, all right. Okay, yes. And so you've got cousins galore and everything. And did you go to a Roman Catholic school?
Yeah, primary and secondary school. I went to convent school.
Did you? And how did you find that?
I loved primary school. I really enjoyed primary school, but I found the transition to secondary school really difficult. I had a very sort of sheltered primary school, and the move to secondary school. I had a very cherished childhood, very sheltered in a healthy way. But when I was suddenly exposed to secondary school and being the small fish in the big pond, I really found that quite a difficult transition, because primary school I was always being quite bright and I'd always done quite well.
Now I find people who've been to convent schools can either become very religious or very antagonistic towards Catholicism. What was your experience?
Oh gosh, as a very small child I just believed what I was told and shown and taught. As soon as I hit secondary school and began to have what I thought was an ability to think for myself, I quickly made the decision that everything that I'd been told and shown was actually complete nonsense. I would say around the age of 14 or 15, I became a very ardent atheist. I wasn't a sceptic or an agnostic or,
And was that atheism something that was just a sort of intellectual decision, or did it show in your lifestyle as well?
Oh, I think the two tied together really quickly, because around, that age of 15, 16, I discovered, I'm not sure what order they went in, atheism, alcohol, boys, and excitement. I just loved excitement. I suddenly had this drive to all the things I'd been that had a don't or shouldn't or a mustn't in front of. I thought, I'm going to do all of them,
right,
because they're going to be fun.
And were they fun?
Oh, they were. Yeah, great. There was great reward in the excitement. I call it now the law of forbidden fruit. And I enjoyed, as I would have said, then getting away with things, because what I always managed to maintain, and that was even from a teenager, was a veneer of respectability. And I knew, even myself then, that my outsides and what I was doing didn't quite match up. I was able to portray a character to the world which really wasn't who I was.
Did you go to church at all? Did you go to confession? Or
only as a child.
But not as a teenager?
No.
You didn't go with a long list of all the...
No, because I'd been enough to know that I'd be told, oh, you're forgiven, and then I'd have been back the week later with the same list of wrongs again,
right,
so
okay.
I knew it was a waste of time.
So this began as a teenager. Of course, it's one thing to have boyfriends when you're 15. It's another thing to have them when you're 25. Did it continue through the 20s?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved men. I
noticed that was past tense. But anyway, well...
I loved the company of men. I drank like a man, like a fish. I loved male company. I loved bars, pubs, clubs. I love being engaged. I love being a fiancé. I was a fiancé about four times, but definitely three, and I think there was a fourth one that didn't last very long.
So you were engaged to four different guys. You broke their hearts.
Oh, I'd love to think so, but I think they were probably glad to be shot me at the end of it.
So have you got five rings somewhere?
Oh, do you know what? I think the only one I ever kept was a really cheap one that came from that awful shop in Argos, that Elizabeth Duke jewellery shop. One was a very, very expensive ring. It was a big sort of fancy.
And did you have to give it back?
That one went back, yeah.
Oh, how annoying. Anyway, all right, but we can laugh about these things, but of course they're tragedies, aren't they?
Oh, they are. It's very sad. And that's the sad thing. I was just thinking that even just came to me, the chap who gave me the ring was a really nice decent, respectable young man, and I met him on a night out, and I must have behaved myself, and you know, we formed this relationship, and he introduced me to his very lovely, I mean, they were like very well-to-do family, and I think they thought, oh, what a lovely girl, but I couldn't sustain, you know, my behaviour. My behaviour always declined into.
And was that because of drink?
Yeah, I mean, drink. Yeah, drink was the drive behind, you know, the sort of Jekyll and Hyde that you know, you would see me at 7 o'clock on a Friday evening, and the person you saw at 7 o'clock on a Friday evening was vastly different to the person you saw at 2 a.m. on Saturday morning. Because once I started drinking, and I didn't know this then, I had very little capacity or ability to control it.
And what were you drinking?
Oh, I drank mostly anything, but I loved, I liked vodka, because I realised, you know, once I did drink, I couldn't stop drinking. I thought people couldn't smell vodka on you, so I liked vodka, but I liked champagne, I liked fine wines. But, you know, as the years went by, I became less discerning. Let's say I started up there in my discernment of alcohol, and as the years travelled on, I drank pretty much anything that headed my way.
And sorry, Bob, but often with drink like this, there are drugs as well. Were you taking drugs?
Yeah, there was drugs. I mean, I went and lived in South America, and that kind of told its own story.
So it's a totally hedonistic lifestyle.
Yeah,
were you working?
Yeah, I'm always managed. I mean, that's the you know, I'm resilient, I'm stubborn, I'm defiant, I'm strong-willed. I've got, you know, great resources within me, and I always managed to hold a job down. I mean, sometimes it was a bit. But I always managed to hold a job and earn a decent living, yeah.
Now, eventually there was a proposal which didn't break off, it led to marriage, so tell us about him, go on.
Well, as I headed on through my 20s, you know, the friends that I'd made around me were all marrying, settling down, and it never appealed to me. I didn't look and envy them, but I was becoming older, and I kind of thought the wild child image and lifestyle that I'd led wasn't appropriate to a 28, 29, 30 year old, and that's where I was headed. And I, at that time, I'd actually met a lovely, lovely man, and I mean genuinely a decent, honest. And the reason I say this, because as I declined over those years, the men I was attracted to and the relationships I got involved in became less and less healthy, shall we say. They became, you know, quite toxic at times. I met a lovely man. He was honest. That was the novelty. He was decent. He had his own business. He was financially secure, which was lovely. And you know, we fell in love.
Was he aware of your addiction to alcohol?
Well, he liked to drink, and we socialised heavily together, and he was a drinker, but he wasn't, you know, what happened to me and continued to happen to me never happened to Paul. It was different. He would probably be classed as a heavy drinker, I would have thought, at worst.
But you feel you were clinically an alcoholic?
Oh, I was. I mean, by the end, I was absolutely, you know, early stages chronic alcoholism, actually, which is a whole new
thing. So what, you were desperate for your next drink when you just finished your last one? Sort
of
thing.
Yeah, but you know, I was drinking when I didn't want to drink, drunk when I've got no intention of being drunk, you know, acquiring alcohol from wherever I could get it. By whatever means, because, you know, obviously by this stage, this is later on, and my family were doing everything they possibly could to
so people were aware of, yes.
Yeah.
Did you do anything to, I don't know, to try and break the
Well, my family started, you know, I got a referral to the doctor, my poor husband on the phone to the doctor, please, you've got to help us, we don't know what's going on, and I just remember, you know, still that ability, the morning of the appointment, I spent hours getting ready, wafting with Chanel No. 5, sparkly lips. I think I wore a fur coat, and how determined I was. And I remember the doctor, I spoke to the doctor, and he asked me about my drinking. I just lied. I just, you know, I told him, I sort of halved what I drank, halved it again, and halved it again. And his suggestion at that point was try and stick to wine and beer, and don't drink before 6 p.m. I can remember that distinctly, because I just took that as a carte blanche to carry on. I was like, oh, he told me I haven't got a problem. And he wrote a letter, because he thought that my husband and I might need some help together. I mean, I think he thought my husband had a problem with, it was something wrong, my husband complaining about this woman, and he wrote, Mrs. Edwards is a charming woman. I thought, well, that's obvious. He can see that I'm, you know, that I'm charming. And, you know, that was the charm, you know, but it does say in the Bible, charm is deceitful.
It does.
My charm was very deceitful.
And during this time, there was no thought of going back to the Lord or thinking about Christian things. You were still an atheist.
No, I'd never even been there. I mean, if I met anyone that spoke about God, I'd one of those big, like, you know, spoiler alerts, like, get away from me as soon as possible.
Right, okay.
If I didn't like the look of you, and if I did, I just felt really pitiful for you that you could be so foolish.
Really, okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you have children?
Yeah, I did. I kind of acquired a baby when I was 23.
He was mine, definitely, but he's now 32, Louis is 32,
but that right. didn't, you know, nothing changed, he just became like an accessory, so he was dressed up and kind of, you know, buffed and cleaned to perfection and just, you know, like a new handbag or a pair of shoes, and he was a child, and baby. So, but once I got married...
So he came into your family?
Yeah, he did, and, you know, Paul took yes. Louis on as his own and right. treated him exactly the same right. as he did the first
And then did you have children yeah. with your husband?
Yeah.
How many?
You know, I actually did things in the suggested order. I got married about a year later. We had our first son, our second child. And, you know, my drinking still continued, and, you know...
So you didn't feel, oh, I should sort of inhibit my drinking out of responsibility for my child?
No. If I'm honest, and I, you know, I'm ashamed to say, and I am ashamed, I drank through all my pregnancies, which is, you know, highly not recommended, mm. but, you know, I know now, looking back, that that's an inability to be able yeah. to control it.
And then you had another child?
Yeah, because of drinking, as soon as I had our second child, my drinking took off in even more proportions afterwards, and I thought, I've got too much time on my hands because I've given up work.
Right.
Because financially we were able to do that, and I tried to become a stay-at-home mum, and the drinking got so bad that I thought I need another baby, and I'll be too busy, and I had sort of two children under two then, and a young child, so mm. three very small children in the home, but that was very close to the end.
And was this doing anything to you physically, you know, what about your liver, for example?
Yeah, my liver was beginning to become distended, and I was also, because I didn't eat, because of I was drinking, and also I was taking lots of amphetamines and other substances. I became painfully thin. I mean, I'm not huge now, but I weighed about 2 stone less than I do now. And I had an enlarged liver, which meant that I always looked as if I was having another baby, which I wasn't. But I just had a very distended tummy.
There were loads of warning signs.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And I was a very attractive shade of yellow.
Right. Wow. So, yeah, things are spiralling down. Your husband loves you, yeah. concerned for you. So how did this all come to a crunch point?
Well, you know, my family decided I needed to stop drinking. They'd obviously made that decision sometime before. They tried to point me in the direction of, you know, an organisation where people with an alcohol problem go, and I went along, and I wasn't overly impressed.
Because?
It was okay. The people were nice. They were very nice. They were friendly. They were warm. They were welcoming. But they had, you know, they had this suggested program, and it mentioned God in it, and I was like, oh my goodness, like.
You really were very antagonistic.
I didn't have a nil reaction to God. As soon as God was mentioned, even the word, I had an internal bristling antagonism of just anger, really.
And that, what was that, because of the school experience, or was it just, I don't know,
what we call original sin,
this sort of antagonism that there is within us towards God?
I would say the latter. I mean, at the time I would have said that it was because, you know, and I had no idea why I had such an inflated idea of my own intellect. It was because I couldn't believe anyone could be so foolish to believe in God. I just thought it was beyond comprehension that you could be so foolish.
Okay, so carry on then. So this... The build-up to where it became very desperate.
Yeah, so I had a brief spell of being dry from going to some meetings and meeting some very nice ladies who helped me. And funny enough, you know, I was saying to you earlier, there was a lady there, and one of the first things she said to me, because I used to make a big effort, I'd go to these meetings, and the one thing I didn't want to do was look like an alcoholic, thank you very much, and nobody else did, but I would make supreme efforts for the externals, and this lady said to me, Yvonne, the shop window looks nice, but what's going on in the stockroom? And I was so cross with her, so angry, because I kind of knew she'd seen through me, and I remember thinking, oh, I thought, how dare you? Yeah. But, you know, so the shop window kind of got back together again for a couple of months, and, you know, my family got renewed hope, and I looked better, I felt better, and all the things that hadn't been happening, I was... You know, the home was kept and appointments were kept and the phone was answered and so forth, all the things that hadn't been happening. But after a period, I was bored with life again, and I just needed, you know, my excitement and my fun back, as I thought. So I drank again and then began a very insane, that was when the chronic alcoholism really kicked in, not for a long period of time, but it was very dark. And what happened at that point, and I'm amazing how it took so long, was my internal kind of mental health deteriorated, and I'd never been a depressive. I was always literally a glass half full. I was always an optimist. you know, I was always that funny disposition, genuinely, and it wasn't, you know, that was part of the facade. But I always tried to see things positively, and that I couldn't. You know, I like this deep inner sort of loneliness and darkness just kind of descended from inward outwardly. It was just a very awful, lonely place to be. And the one thing, you know, and I often share this with people, you know, for me as a human being, as a mum, the greatest emotion I've ever known is the love I felt for my children. Mm. You know, the minute those boys were born, even now, I'm just like, I fell in love with my children. Mm. And I could not stop drinking for them. I saw what was happening, you know,
and they saw it as well, presumably.
Well, they were very, tiny, but the slightly older ones, the family did. And I just couldn't. And someone said to me, you know, if you loved your children, your family, if you loved your children, you'd stop drinking. I couldn't. I could not stop. Mm. And I realised, you know, what liability I was in the home. Mm. And I, you know, in a very short period of time, the darkness was so deep and so great that I really thought it would be. But I didn't have a suicidal wish, but I just didn't want to be here anymore. Mm. I really didn't. I just used to, you know, collapse drunk into bed and just think, don't let me wake up in the morning, I don't want to wake up in the morning. And I did, and in the end I decided I'd just, you know, sort that out. So when I took a massive overdose of whatever was in the medicine cabinet, I took a lot.
Did you?
Yeah.
And you're found, clearly.
I was found, yeah, my neighbour found me. Yeah.
And what?
I happened to work in A&E as well.
Oh, right, okay, so 999, you find yourself in hospital.
Hospital, yeah.
And they sent you specialised help.
Yeah.
Where did you go?
Well, I went to the Priory, which that very first thing, I thought it was the Priory, I'm like Kate Moss, or I don't know if Kate Moss has been to the Priory. I'm like, no. there'll be a swimming pool and a sauna and it'll be lovely and whatever. But yeah, it's a psychiatric hospital, you have to call it what it is.
It's a private psychiatric hospital,
yeah.
So you went there?
Yeah, and that was August Bank Holiday 1995.
Right. And were there any help?
Well, I mean, it was lovely. The grounds were beautiful. I had my own room. The food was lovely. I had a chef and he cooked what you wanted. And it was just, but there wasn't very many people there. I think I went in on the kind of Wednesday leading up to the bank holiday. And by the Friday, there were no people for me to play with. So I was a little bit bored. But I was wandering the grounds and being well fed. And I felt better. I felt a little bit more peaceful. Mm. Within myself, and I actually didn't, and it was for the first time in a long, long time, I didn't have that desperate, overwhelming urge to go and get alcohol. I mean, that hadn't been, you know, I hadn't felt like that for a long, long time.
But you found something in your room. I'm moving you on. I'm sorry, it's just because of time, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, I'd only been there for a couple of days. And I did start to remember a few of the things that the people in those funny meetings had said, and when they'd spoken about God and how God had helped them and whatever. And that did play on my mind a little bit, but I went to my room and I opened the drawer in my room. And when I'd gone in such a hurry, I hadn't had time to pack loads of stuff, so I had no reading material. And I opened the drawer, and I'd always say if there'd been a Vogue or a Cosmopolitan or a OK magazine, I would have read that, but the only thing in the drawer was a Bible. So I took the Bible.
This was a Gideon Bible that was placed in hotels and schools.
Yeah.
Go on, see that Bible.
I took the Bible out, and I knew enough to know there was an Old Testament which no one ever read, and there was a New Testament which was a bit about Jesus. So I was like, oh. So I just flicked to the New Testament, and it, it opened, and there was a chapter called, it was Luke, and it was, funny enough, there were little testaments that you've got on your seats, it was Luke chapter 7, and I just read, and it was a very not dissimilar story to the story you read out at the beginning of a woman, and I, the words I read, it was that there was a woman, and she knew she was a sinner, and in that instant, I just knew that's what had been wrong with me, that all the stuff, I knew I was a sinner, and I didn't know how I knew at the time. I was like, I know I'm a sinner, and I read down through the story, and this woman who knew she was a sinner had come and knelt at the feet of Jesus, and she'd wept for her sins, and as I was
because presumably the psychiatrist would be questioning you about, you know, did something happen in your childhood, and all this sort of thing. But you saw yourself differently.
Yeah, differently. Yeah, no, it wasn't, you know, all the things like which have low self-esteem. No, it's not. I've got a huge ego and a very healthy ego. And I'm a proud, arrogant human being. I don't have a problem with my self-esteem or my, you know, if something happened in my childhood, it's very deeply buried because I've never remembered it.
So you saw yourself as a sinner, and then what?
Well, I read down this story, and you know, the main characters are Jesus, this very important man called a Pharisee, and this poor woman who was a sinner. And the very important man is looking at her and thinking, if Jesus knew what sort of woman that was, he wouldn't even let her touch him. Because as I know now, she would have made Jesus unclean. As I read through the story, you know, the part that I came to was when Jesus said to the important man, you know, if somebody owes you a large debt and you forgive them, and somebody owes you a small debt and you forgive them, who do you think will love you more? And the man rightly said, well, the person who owes you the really large debt. And I just saw my life, the life I'd led was my debt. I'd led the life is a gift, so a gift from God, and the way I'd led my life was dreadful, you know, to think God had given me the gift of life and health and family and home, and I'd done everything all but destroy it, and I saw that, and yet, you know, at the end of the story, Jesus says to the woman, you know, your faith has saved you, go in peace, and I'd never ever known peace in my life. I'd known kind of circumstantial peace for when all the ducks were in a row and, you know, everything was well on my horizon, but I'd never known it in peace. And at that moment, you know, the Lord Jesus came into my heart. And
well, you knelt and prayed, didn't you?
I knelt and prayed, and wept.
And you asked Jesus to forgive you?
Yeah.
You understood he died for you?
Absolutely.
And you asked him to become your Lord and Saviour. Now, what was the impact of that?
Well, the instant impact was at that peace. I just felt at peace, and it was at peace with God, and it wasn't I'm at peace because, or there was no circumstance attached to it. I just felt an incredible inner peace, and it was evening time by now, and I remember being concerned. I knew something had happened to me, and I was on no medication. I just say that because most people who are in places like that, like I was, you're on certain medication to kind of wean you, but I wasn't taking anything. I think they gave me vitamin B tablets, that was it. So I knew this was a real experience. This wasn't a sort of drug-fueled or drug-induced experience. I was tired and I went to sleep. I was actually very childlike. I was frightened that God would have gone away in the morning. And I remember praying, God, please don't leave me. Please still be there when I wake up. And God was, and he still is, 22.
And the desire for drink?
Just left me, absolutely. It's never, ever returned.
And you said to me as well about the distended body.
I had the tummy that looked like I was, probably looked about 6 months, in the morning my liver had just returned to its normal size.
Amazing. And you've never desired to go back to the alcohol?
Never. I'm incredibly grateful for that, because I know that's not everybody's experience, but you know.
And just very quickly, you mentioned as well that your husband, he died then.
He did. It was about 10 years
together,
and then on the 29th of September 2005, he left to play squash, and he had a massive heart attack on the squash court. And the boys were 10 and 12 and 19.
Amazing. I'd love to ask you loads more questions. Time rushes on, doesn't it, when we're speaking? No, don't be sorry at all. That was incredible. Probably most people will have to dash off, but you'd be around for a few minutes to talk if you want. Yeah. Thank you. Let's show our appreciation. Thank you.
sorry to rush you on, really, because it's that amazing story. And I often think about these stories. I'd love to have somebody like Richard Dawkins on the front row and turn at the end and say, now, just explain that, will you please? What happened there? Because there is, to my mind, no explanation apart from a true and living God who breaks into a life like that. That's great. Thank you very much for being so honest. And apparently the Gideons, if there are any Gideons here, are not even aware of this story, so it's a good place to that Bible. Let's go back to this story I read at the very beginning, because it does tie in very clearly, doesn't it, with what we've just heard from Yvonne. If you're one of those Bible students who scrutinises these things, you know this particular passage is one that's been debated over hugely. And scholars come to, oh, it's in the wrong place in John, oh, it shouldn't be in John, and da da da. Leon Morris, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, said, whether it's in the right place or not doesn't actually matter. It rings true. It is authentic. It reflects common experience. And he said, yes, okay, perhaps it may not be in that spot, it perhaps should be a little bit later or a little bit earlier, but the point is, clearly, this is something that happened. And really, it was party time for Jerusalem. They celebrated a time when life had been much more difficult for them, and every year they would reflect back on the time when they were wandering in the wilderness. And what happened, that apparently every Israelite at that time was legally obliged to go to Jerusalem and to celebrate. And Jerusalem became a sort of happy shanty town as people lived in booths made of palm leaves and just clearly they didn't have the frost that we have, but nevertheless they were out in the open, dancing, drinking, merrymaking. This was an amazing time for the Jews, a very, very happy festival. I suppose if it was happening on stage and we were watching from the balcony, our eyes would be seeing all these people laughing and joking and having a great time, and then perhaps our eyes would focus on one particular woman who, for whatever reason, this time of year, was alone. Whether her husband was away on business, whether things weren't good between them, who knows, whether he was sick, but she was alone. And I suppose if it was a stage, the focus of the beam would be on her, and we'd be watching her as she mingled, and nobody seems to see her until she bumps into one particular guy who begins chatting, and suddenly a smile comes back to her face, and for once she doesn't quite feel so lonely. She feels attractive again. She's enjoying the banter between this man whom she's just met. They enjoy the evening together. And eventually, eventually they sort of exit the stage and they go to their own tent and they become entwined in an affair. I suppose it's the sort of thing that could be repeated hundreds, maybe thousands of times, most nights across the City of London, you know, and a common experience. But going absolutely contrary to the God who says that yes, sex is a wonderful gift given by God, but to be enjoyed in a selfless way in the confines of the security of marriage. But she was being unfaithful. Well, the next morning, very, very early in the morning, Jesus was up and speaking to the crowds. And they were there, you know, early risers, listening to the teaching of the Lord Jesus. One would love to hear some of these messages that he gave. But I remember like that. It was once walking for 7 miles with a couple, just expounding the Bible. And you sort of think, oh, I wish all that had been recorded. Love to study, see what he was saying. But anyway, but he was speaking to the crowds. But there are some Pharisees. They were a very strict, sort of self-righteous group of religious leaders. They saw everything right in themselves and everything wrong in everybody else. They are making their way early morning towards the temple. And as they are, they see this couple still enjoying love, still in their intimate affair together. And they turn and they grab this woman. Now, people were speculating, why didn't they grab the man? And who knows the answer to that? Some have suggested perhaps he was one of them. It's an interesting thought, but we don't know. They grabbed the woman, and you can sort of imagine her sort of reaching out, clutching her garment, trying to cover herself, and they drag her, stumbling, probably sobbing, through the streets towards the temple, and there is Jesus with this crowd to whom he's speaking. And they just throw this woman in front of Jesus. and they say, right, we found this woman committing adultery. We found her in the very act of adultery. Now, our law says such a woman should be stoned to death. What do you say? And really, they're out to trap him, because if he said, no, give her a second chance, then the Jews would be greatly offended. On the other hand, if he said, yes, stone her to death, then the Romans would be greatly offended. So they really think, we've got him. And it's interesting what Jesus does, because he bends down, he stoops down, and he writes something in the dust of the ground. Now again, one would love to know what he's written. It's the only thing that we know that he ever wrote. He wrote something there. I once heard Billy Graham, the American preacher, suggest that perhaps he wrote out the Ten Commandments. Well, it's an interesting idea. There's a little verse tucked away in the Old Testament part, Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 13. It says, those who depart from your law will have their name written in the dust of the ground. So, who knows? Again, he writes. It's almost as if he doesn't hear these people. Clearly he has, but he makes as if he has. He's writing something, and they become all agitated. Come on, what do you say? We've got this woman here, she committed adultery. Now, do we not stone her? And Jesus stands up, and his piercing eyes, which I'm sure have a look of compassion, but also anger at the attitude of these religious leaders, look at them all, and then say, the one here who is without sin, let him throw the first stone at her. And then he bends and stoops and writes again. Now, of course, there was somebody there without sin. That was Jesus. He never did anything wrong, but he doesn't want to stone her to death. And if, again, if we were watching on a stage, there'd be a sort of long, silent pause. You'd think, what's going to happen? And then there's an old Pharisee, and he sort of just moves off stage. And then the next oldest. In fact, from the oldest to the youngest, their consciences smite them. Conscience is that sort of inward judgment seat that dares to judge against us. Sometimes it's, Roger, you're wrong. You shouldn't play that. You shouldn't. And you think, oh, just leave me alone. But it's there. You can kill it off eventually, but we'll leave that for the moment. And they all move away, and it's just Jesus and this woman, and of course the crowd who is speaking, who are left watching all of these things. And Jesus turns and says, does nobody condemn you? And she sort of looks up, and she looks in a sight, you know, the mascara running, the tears coming down her face. She's probably disheveled and really frightened, no idea what's going to happen next. But she looks up and says, no one, Lord. And then Jesus says, well, neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more. What a statement. She was literally a stone's throw away from death, wasn't she? She's right there. And now she's given a reprieve, forgiveness. Now go and sin no more. It's not that Jesus is excusing sin. Of course not. He lived a perfect, pure, holy life. And he taught purity and holiness. In fact, he takes some of the commandments with which we're familiar and sort of drives them home, as it were, convicting all of us. You shall not kill. I've never killed anybody. But if you have hate in your heart, oh right, in God's sight, that's seen as murder. Well, all right, then I am guilty. You shall not commit adultery. Well, again, I haven't committed adultery, but Jesus goes much further. If you have lust towards somebody, all right, well, again, I've been found out. So Jesus isn't excusing this woman's wrongdoing, but he is also giving her an opportunity to start again, to find forgiveness. But it's interesting now what happens, because neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. And then Jesus sort of lifts up his eyes, no doubt his voice as well, and he says to the crowd, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. What a statement that comes in the context of this incident. But it's there deliberately, and Jesus spoke these words deliberately. Because when light shines, it exposes sin, wrongdoing. And when sin is exposed, one can do one of two things. You can walk away and remain in your sin, which of course is what the Pharisees did. Or you can stay with Jesus and let him deal with it. which is what that woman did. So here's Yvonne in the priory, and, you know, bored, she's in her room, pulls out from the drawer, and there's a Gideon Bible, and opens it, Luke chapter 7, and reads about that sinful woman. Now, at that moment, she could, as it were, put the Bible back, close the drawer, walk out, wander around the gardens, I suppose, have another meal. On the other hand, she stayed put and allowed God to take hold of his word, which is what he does. When you start to read, God takes hold of his written word, and he sort of pierces our heart with it, and allowed him to deal with her, as he did with this woman all those years ago. I think this is an amazing story. Now, this is the Jesus who is able to forgive and to say things like, neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. But think about it for a moment. There would be an act of injustice if that's all we had from the Gospels. Yesterday evening, I was interviewing a high court judge. I think I must say I'd rather interview him than him in a formal situation interview me. So I was interviewing the high court judge, and he sort of mused a little on the whole idea of justice and that sense within us all that there should be right and wrong, a little child shouting out, that's not fair. Where do they get that innate sense of justice, the right and wrong, and fair play? Well, the God who made us in his image is a God of justice. Then how can Jesus say to an adulterous woman, neither do I condemn you? And of course the answer is that eventually this same Jesus was going to go to a cross, and he would take on himself that woman's adultery, the drunkenness, the wild behaviour, the atheism, the antagonism, the sort of pushing God to the edge of the plate of our lives. And we're all guilty of that, aren't we? Shakespeare said, conscience makes cowards of us all. Well, it did to those Pharisees, but they didn't do anything about it. They remained as they were. But when Jesus was on the cross, he, like a magnet, attracted everything which is opposite and contrary onto himself. And he, the pure, lovely Son of God, took all our wrongness. Time's gone, but I think it's one of the evidences that Jesus really is who he claimed to be, namely God. Because you think of the sins of the ages, the sins of the world, compressed into 3 hours and laid on Jesus. Well, if it had been laid on me, my mind would have exploded. Psychologically, I couldn't cope with that. But Jesus takes the weight of it. It never contaminated him, but he took this crushing load. And out of love for us, he died for us. So that if we ask him, we can indeed be forgiven. And this is the risen Jesus. The power of God at work to bring Jesus back to life. That same personal power is available to us. So last Friday in Bournemouth, I interviewed somebody very similar, who's a journalist from the Bournemouth Echo. And he would go into work drunk from the night before, and he'd go through work drunk, and then he'd go, he was a saxophonist as well in the evening in clubs, and he'd drink more and more, and car crashes and all kinds of drink. The moment he asked Jesus Christ to be his Lord and Saviour, he did it in the toilet of the men's loos in the Bournemouth Echo, because he just needed somewhere to go alone, and he went into a cubicle, closed the door, and on the loo floor he knelt. And he cried out to God and he said, God, will you save me and forgive me? And like you, he got the alcoholism went. In a split second, it went. Now, that doesn't happen to everybody, but it certainly on these two occasions it did. Now, I don't know where you're at as far as God is concerned, but I do want to say, if I may, he knows what we're like. He does expose sin, but he doesn't do it so that we might sort of grovel with guilt, but that we might come to him and say, Lord Jesus, if you died for me, then please forgive me. And if you rose from the dead, of course you did, please come and live in my life. Become my Lord and Saviour. And I guarantee, if you do that, even here this afternoon, he would forgive you. And he'll make all things new. And that lasts not just for time, but for eternity. Heaven and hell really depend on what we do with Jesus. We all need forgiveness. And he offers it. And we come. And we receive. and we never, never regret it. Time's gone. I've got 3 minutes left, and I don't know whether anybody wanted to ask Yvonne a question. I think probably we'll just do it in a private capacity now. I'd love to have said, can we open this up, but perhaps it's time to finish. But thanks ever so much. Tomorrow I'm going to be interviewing a guy converted to Christ in the Mays prison where he was serving time for murder. He was a UVF terrorist. It's the most dramatic of stories. And but you'll see the programme. John, let me hand back to you. Thank you all very much. Thank you.